Hello, welcome to episode 17 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that bored man. My name is Graham Lee. So I want to follow on from episode 16 on Apple and RISC-V. But the feedback I've had has been that maybe it would be too expensive for Apple to consider a switch to RISC-V from ARM, given that they've spent all of this money on investing in and developing their chipset. But remember, I'm talking about something that's going to be happening within the next sort of 10 to 15 years. So there's plenty of time for Apple to invest in something else. And if they're worried about losing their existing investment, that's a sunk cost fallacy. That's not really a great way to go about business. And by the time we get to that hypothesized 2030 something WWDC talk, where Apple tell us that the next CPU generation in the Macs and presumably in all of their other devices is going to be RISC-V based, the CPU is really going to be the least interesting part of any of the machines that they sell, any of the electronic devices that Apple create. And this episode is really about that. It's mostly based on a talk that Sophie Wilson, the designer of the ARM chip and the CTO at Broadcom, gave in 2016 called The Future of Microprocessors. And my apologies to Alan Francis, who linked me this talk after I'd already prepared the show notes for this episode, but before I'd recorded it, and said, here's the thing that would be interesting to you. Yes, indeed, it is interesting to me. I had watched it and I had already prepared this podcast episode, but I mistakenly told him that I'd already referred to this talk in a podcast. I haven't, because it's this episode which had yet to be recorded at the time. So apologies, Alan. Now, the starting point for Sophie Wilson's discussion of modern and future processors, microelectronics in general, is this idea that Moore's law is dead. And the way that she presents it in the talk is by showing that the previous idea that you could double the transistor count on a given piece of silicon every 2 years relied on the power consumption, or the power generated, the heat generated by the silicon going up by the same exponential growth factor. If you wanted to make if you wanted to make transistors that were half the size in each direction, so fit four times as many transistors onto a die, you were generating four times as much heat, or the same heat over one quarter of the area. So we got to the end of the curve that we could supply the same power to each transistor, and Intel fell off this curve with the Pentium 4, which is probably still the fastest clocked CPU that they've ever made, with its sort of 3.6 gigahertz, 4 gigahertz cycle frequency. So we've been able to carry on making smaller and smaller transistors, but we can no longer power them to the same extent that we were previously powering the larger transistors. We either have to rely on lower voltage parts, which have their own electronic characteristics and trade-offs, or turn off bits of the chip so that you've got a chip with many more transistors on it but can't use them all at the same time, and so you know, can't increase like parallelism or whatever in the same extent that you could do before, or can't have multiple instructions in flight in a pipeline to the same extent that you could with the previous generation of transistor. So making smaller transistors is getting harder and getting more expensive, and powering those transistors has basically hit a wall. And so those things together mean that we've actually got past the point where we can just carry on doubling transistor counts in the same space every 2 years. She points out in the talk that that wasn't what Moore originally said, that Moore's law has survived for so long by being continually modified over the lifetime of the law. But I'm going to leave that to Sophie Wilson to explain more. There's a link to her talk in the show notes. Now, the CEO of NVIDIA, who is regulatory hurdles notwithstanding, the new owner of Arm, and either the new CEO of Arm or the boss of Simon Segars, who's the current CEO of Arm, we don't know how that's going to pan out yet, proposed recently Huang's law, which is basically Moore's law, but saying for AI. Now, it may be that a kind of Moore's law for AI, you can double the machine learning capability on a equivalent piece of silicon every couple of years or 18 months or whatever. In the short term, that's probably because AI in silicon isn't very mature invention yet, and that there are still quick wins and performance enhancements as applications become better understood, algorithms become better implemented in silico, and so on. Not because the process for making an AI in silicon chip is any different from making a general purpose CPU. So really, the laws, the physical constraints that make Moore's law no longer apply also apply to Huang's law. We just may not have reached the point where the physical constraints are a limiting factor in that particular domain yet. Now, something that isn't dead, and Sophie Wilson makes this point in her video as well, is Amdahl's law, because Amdahl's law is just maths. What this law says is that the concurrency speed up you get by parallelizing your application is limited by the fraction of the application that has to run sequentially. For example, let's say that you've got an application that's 50% parallel code and 50% sequential code. If you had an infinite number of CPUs or an infinite number of cores on which to run this program, you would get a 50% speed up because you would run the sequential part on one core and it would take the same time that it did before, and you would run the parallel part on infinite cores and it would take zero time. You know, mathematically speaking, obviously that's an approximation and physically wouldn't work. But that limit is an upper bound. You could never make it run in one third of the time on same speed CPUs just by adding more cores to the problem. So we need to talk here about the difference between parallel code and concurrent code. Code that can run in parallel is code where a CPU or a number of CPUs can theoretically run the multiple sets of instructions side by side and still get a correct result, which can't happen with sequential code. Concurrent code is parallel code in which those parallel parts of the execution actually do happen at the same time. You can obviously have parallel code running on a single core computer that's context switching between the parallel segments and so isn't running them concurrently. Most end user applications are effectively sequential for the most part. There's the what's called the main thread or the event loop or the looper or the dispatcher or whatever you call it, which is waiting for a UI event, is dispatching the event handler, is then updating state based on that event, and then updating UI based on the state, and then going back to wait for the next event to come in. And like you're basically all GUI applications work this way. Now, if you're using a modern programming environment, then you're probably using some kind of async task dispatcher from that main loop to run the handler, the thing that actually processes the event in some other context. But that doesn't make it concurrent because you can't handle the event and dispatch the event on the same thread because you have to know what the event is. You have to have received it and decoded it in order to know what handler to run. So, you've moved the state, you've moved like the execution state from the UI thread to somewhere else so that the event loop can start running again, but it can't do any of the stuff that relies on the on the computation being finished until the computation is finished. So you've still got a sequential application. What you're really doing is just allowing things like application animations to run to completion, or allowing the program to handle unrelated additional UI events that come in. In practice, many applications don't have too many different things that they can do at once. And in practice, many users focus on a single task at a time, so don't try to do too many things at once in an application. And so you get mostly sequential execution. Now, the various operating systems have components or technologies in place that make this thing particularly easy or particularly effective, this idea of effectively sequentially switching to an asynchronous execution state. So the Mach kernel from version 4, but I think it's been backported into the macOS 10 kernel, has this thing called shuttles. The Solaris kernel has this thing called doors, where a change of context from one thread to another, or from one process to another, can be achieved by jumping from the source process to the destination process, or from the calling thread to the receiving thread, without losing the time slice. So rather than putting the first process to sleep and then writing an event onto the queue of the second process that then has to wait for the scheduler to wake it up to receive that event, you copy the event from the first thread's memory to the second thread's memory, and then just jump into the event handler in that second thread. And that makes it quicker on a multitasking operating system, but not necessarily on a multi-core operating system, because you're still doing this sequentially, because you're doing it within one time slice, so on one core. But it makes it quicker to switch between these different contexts. And so that means that for like most graphical apps, you know, most like end user computing devices, there isn't actually a whole lot of benefit to adding more and more cores. You can maybe get some of the operating system's background tasks done while the user is also doing something else. You can maybe run more of their apps in parallel, but again, like most of the time, the user is focused on one task, and so it's only really taxing one of the applications. There might be background things like, you know, getting their email in the background on a different processor core or something, but there's not going to be that much of a benefit. It's not going to speed up their computing experience linearly with the number of cores you add. Particularly, more apps you run concurrently means more memory pressure, and so you start killing processes because they're using memory that you need to reclaim, rather than failing to schedule processes because you don't have enough cores to run them on. So again, we're not doing much more by adding more and more CPU cores. So this is a problem for people who want to sell the current generation of computer as better than the previous generation of computer, because you can't carry on adding cores and get improved performance. So you can't say this computer is faster than that computer because it's got 16 cores and that one's got 8. I mean, you obviously can claim that, but it's as much of a myth as like the megahertz myth was. And the megahertz myth has become essentially redundant, because you can no longer make sequential code faster either, which means you can't make application code faster. Almost all of the clever performance enhancement in CPU speed over the lifetime of like the microcomputer, so from the 70s until now, has been in making the transistors faster, making them smaller, making them switch faster. And now that we've got to the point where we're incapable of doing that and still powering the CPU and still drawing the heat away from the CPU, we can no longer rely on those transistors getting faster. There was also some performance increase in some clever bits of silicon engineering, adding things like CPU pipelining, adding speculative execution. That made computers a few orders of magnitude faster than they had been before. But making the transistors faster made them millions of times faster than they had been before. And then there were also some speed improvements that came from software advances. However, those may have been entirely swamped by adding all of the extra expectations to the software, so that as we used a better algorithm for indexing the different components of a word processor document, we also added live spell checking to the document, which meant that we were trying to do more with this index and slowed the application down again. That's not a dig. If you can do more, it is reasonable to do more, because you will have a more competitive product, because people tend to measure software based on its features and its capabilities more than on its performance or correctness, because like you can only really compare upfront features and capabilities. You don't find out about the performance and stability and correctness and so on until you're already using it, by which time you've probably already bought it. So it is reasonable to do more if people want you to do more, and if it appears that you can do more. So it is entirely reasonable that software contribution to the speed of a computer has actually been negative rather than positive. So what am I saying? Well, the transistor speed improvement means let's take a 1970s CPU, like the MOS 6502 that was in the Apple II and the Commodore 64 and the Acorn computers and a whole lot of different microcomputers from the 70s and the 80s. Let's take that 6502 and let's make it today. Let's contract Texas Instruments or TSMC to make that chip on a 28 nanometer process. In fact, let's be specific. Let's say that we took this mythical 28 nanometer 6502 and we ran VisiCalc, the first spreadsheet by Dan Bricklin, on it. It would be millions of times faster than VisiCalc on the Apple II or on the Commodore 64. It would be slower than the same software ported to a modern 28 nanometer process CPU, like an ARM chip or an Intel chip. But it would probably, maybe, be faster than a modern spreadsheet application running on an equivalent chip. Now, I've picked the 28 nanometer process because that's where Wilson says that the trade-off between miniaturizing your transistors in your semiconductor process and power constraints is at its sweet spot. You can make smaller chips. Indeed, Apple are now using TSMC's 5 nanometer process for their A14 series. But if you do so, you have to turn off more and more of the silicon. So if you try to miniaturize the 6502 down to 5 nanometers, you essentially wouldn't have a working 6502. It would get too hot because the entire thing would need to be switched on. It isn't designed to work on a smaller and more modern silicon process. And you can see this in the situations where people are making modern versions of existing CPUs. If you compare the 420 nanometer Motorola 68060 running at 75 megahertz with the Apollo 68080, which is an implementation of the same instruction set or a very similar instruction set in just an off-the-shelf FPGA part. The FPGA implementation is orders of magnitude faster at executing exactly the same instruction set. So the good performance advances have come from making the transistors faster, or at least the good performance advances in CPUs have come from making the transistors faster, and we've got to the point where it's no longer easy to make the transistors faster and keep a chip design that looks enough like a CPU to run CPU tasks well. Now we've got to the point where you have to get your advances by using application-specific silicon so that you can design around the thermal constraints and the application's needs in parallel, or consider both of these factors in your chip design and make chips that work well at smaller processes and at solving the particular problems that you need your electronics to solve. You have to design the hardware with applications in mind. And of course, we've already been talking about Huang's law and NVIDIA. The GPU is the best example of application-specific silicon in what we would recognize as a computer, you know, a sort of box computer rather than like any old electronics device like a car fuel injection circuit or a washing machine or a smart light bulb or whatever. There have been graphics-specific silicon implementations in computers for decades. For example, the Amiga chipset, which is mostly about having this custom graphics capability that had shared access to the RAM with the CPU, but that offloaded a load of the instructions from the CPU. Going back before that, the video circuitry in the Commodore 64 and similar computers was often on a specific chip. Sometimes these were what was called an uncommitted logic array, which was a sort of programmable or configurable silicon, much like an FPGA. The ability of GPUs to do graphic-specific things has, over the decades, got faster much quicker than the ability of the CPUs to do generic computery things. So first we had like multiple polygon support for 3D environments, then shader support for texturing 3D environments, and so on, and you know, much more advances because these are very constrained problems. We can design the silicon to solve that constrained problem a lot better than we can design faster versions of general purpose silicon. And so now, if you make your problem look sufficiently like a graphics problem, if you can recast your mathematics as a shader mathematics, then you can run it on a GPU and get much better results and much better improvements in results for continued hardware investment over time than you would get on a CPU. Look at a programming environment like CUDA, which takes advantage of this, but also, note, we'll come back to CUDA to when we come to talk about the limitations of that kind of programming. Similar example is very specific maths problems like vector processing and, in general, single instruction, multiple data. Think of the Altavec units on the PowerPC made by Motorola and IBM, of the MMX or SSE2 or SSE3 or AVX512 vector instruction sets on Intel, or the scalable vector extensions on ARM, or you know, the equivalents on other CPU families. The ability of the arithmetic logic unit to do maths has got faster by making the maths happen in parallel by like an order of magnitude, as well as the increases in transistor speed. So if you can make your problem into a do this maths in parallel problem, you can take advantage of that speed up. But you need to be able to program your solution to take advantage of that. Another modern example would be neural engines, TPUs, machine learning chips like NVIDIA's new business line. Again, if you can make your problem look like a machine learning problem, if you can make it look like backpropagation in a neural net, i.e. a massive matrix multiplication problem, then you can take advantage of that silicon and your solution will be faster than if you still have to run it on a CPU. We can make those application-specific circuits faster than we can make CPUs, and we can make improvements to the speed of those faster than we can make improvements to the speeds of CPUs. Also look at SSL or cryptography offload engines, or TCP offload, or cryptocurrency application-specific integrated circuits, or digital signal processing, video encoding, broadband signals, multiplexing, demultiplexing. Any of these problem domains, we can make silicon, like specific application-specific integrated circuits that will improve the speed at which a computer can handle those, mostly by taking that work out of a slow and cumbersome general purpose CPU and putting it into this faster application specific circuit. But as I mentioned, the problem is none of these look like sequential general purpose Turing complete problems. They look like vector problems, or they look like machine learning problems, or they look like shader problems, or they look like demuxing, or they look like cryptocurrency. They don't look like the way in which we've been designing and writing software for decades, and so they don't look like the kinds of problems that we can solve with programming languages that we've been used to, which is basically the C model. Not that C was the first of these, you know, where I could equivalently call it like the Algol model or something, but this idea of sequential instructions that can be maybe reordered by an optimizing compiler, but that generally like load from the memory, work on some numbers, then store the numbers back out in the memory. This the model that many programmers have in their mind of a computer, which hasn't really moved on that much from, say, the Zilog Z80 MOS 6502 days, except in terms of the width of the data that the processor is acting on. We haven't caught up with this. You know, even a modern programming language, something like Swift, is still just running CPU code. It might be able to access specific features of GPUs or neural processors or cryptography engines or something by calling out to libraries that then call out to what are called intrinsics, by which we really mean like machine language instructions for those specific circuits. But all of the design and all of the like marshalling of data and putting stuff in memory and dealing with the results and everything, that's all still done on a CPU, and the CPUs aren't getting any better. They're just using more power to effectively sort of do the same stuff. So, and in some cases, the intrinsics aren't even machine instructions. You look at something like the tensor processing units from Google. When you call out to one of those, you basically make an asynchronous networking call, gRPC is the protocol, to an entirely standalone computer running on this board that then makes the TPUs do their thing and then like sends you a signal with the data back. Anyway, the point is that our programs that are designed the way that we design programs with like product owners and scrum masters and programmers or software engineers and QAs and all these kinds of people, these are all no longer capable of even doing the things that we need a computer to do in order to get good use out of modern silicon. They're only capable of calling out to something else that can do it. Because of the limitations of the sort of model of the programming language and model of the sequential execution of instructions and the compatibility of that model with what we need to do to get the most out of the silicon. If you look at the Sophie Wilson talk, she mentions that the Broadcom chips that she's describing have essentially a sort of parallel dispatch thing, where if you can say the two instructions that you need to execute as and issue them as a single machine code instruction, then they can happen entirely in parallel. But there is no way, even with like, you know, multi-threading or an async task dispatch model in a like library on top of a C-style programming language, there's no way to say I need like the left 64 bits of this register to be fused, multiply and added, and the right 64 bits of this register to be convolved as a four matrix, as a four vector, at the same time, because you never know when those two distinct instructions are going to occur at the same point in parallel. We're not designing parallel code, we're not designing concurrent code, we're designing parallel code and then relying on CPU concurrency. But we can no longer grow CPU concurrency, partly because of Amdahl's law. There just isn't enough work to do concurrently anymore, and because of the power consumption needs. We need to turn off a bunch of the cores in the CPU to stop it overheating and switch between smaller parts of the circuitry, you know, maybe not whole cores, but maybe like we need to switch the ALU off over here while we're running the FPU over here or something. So we can't just rely on generically having access to all of the CPU hardware, even if it is all designed in the silicon and could in principle be used by the software that we have written. So this is a situation that is going to increase over time. We're going to get better and better neural chipsets, we're going to get better and better crypto offloaders, we're going to get better and better vector units, we're going to get better and better GPUs, and so we're going to have more of the CPUs sitting there getting warm and saying, could I have the result back from that calculation, and less of it doing real work. But we still design our applications for the CPU model of computer. Eventually, a best practices CPU application will end up just doing event handling and shuttling memory blocks around, preparing them for the rest of this application circuit, and then coordinate the workflows, but not really do any of the work itself. It will probably even like be shut off most of the time. So a future version of instruments won't say you're using a lot of CPU here. It will say you're turning on the CPU at this point. But like I said, we've got this conflicting problem. Now, that would be a best practice, but our current practice is to do everything in the CPU and then wonder about, is there a way that I can optimize this function using the GPU? Or even not to do that, but to ask, is there a library that does that for us, because we don't understand how to make use of this silicon ourselves? That's really where the state of the art is. So if you look at something like CUDA, which I mentioned before, which was NVIDIA's tool for writing C-looking programs, but that run on GPUs, it's a very capable environment, and indeed it's won them a lot of support in the high-performance computing world, because it is like probably the best tool for that purpose. But because it's very hard for people who've grown up with traditional methods of computing, and remember, high performance computing is mostly Fortran and C++, some Python, Programmers who use the Fortran and C++ and some Python want to write general purpose Turing complete programming code, but a GPU can't run that code very well. If you write a conditional statement in code for your GPU, you have to run the program twice. You have to run it once for the true condition in the branch, once for the false condition in the branch. You run it that, so you run the whole thing twice, but in parallel over, you know, your warp, which might be 32, 64, 128 concurrent cores. And then you look at what the condition was and you throw away 50% of the values in order to get the correct answers. So the way to increase the uptake, you know, the adoption of a thing like CUDA has been to make it more and more like a general purpose programming environment, to add things like conditional statements and loops, to add transparent memory sharing between the CPU and the GPUs. But the underlying computational model is one where the hardware can't execute conditional statements. It can't do loops very effectively unless they are loops of a constant size. So you want to run the same thing 256 times or whatever. And it has non-uniform memory. It has some memory that is tied closely to the GPUs and some memory that is tied closely to the CPUs. So the more you make it look like a general purpose programming language, the less you can take advantage of the specific hardware facilities that motivated introducing the environment in the first place. We're actually going to have to take a whole new look at the way that we solve problems in software in order to carry on getting the most out of our modern silicon engineering. CPU-bound software probably won't get much faster ever now. ASIC-bound software can certainly get faster, not for the general problems that a lot of us are solving with computers, but for specific problems where we need to solve the same mathematics or the same recipe over and over again many, many times with particular constraints. There'll be a few sweet spots where the problem is big enough and expensive enough that we want to spend the money on it, where the silicon engineering has got us into a place where the silicon design can actually solve the problem, and the problem is amenable to this kind of engineering. There will be a few places where that all comes together. But unless we have a complete change in the way in which we do our programming, we won't be able to take advantage of it. But what this means is that for companies like Apple or like Oracle, who are designing their own silicon in their vertically integrated systems, you know, Oracle have got application-specific circuitry on modern Spark CPUs for doing database things, because they want the Oracle database, where they get a lot of recurring licensing revenue, to run faster on Oracle hardware, where they get, you know, the sort of big one-off sales revenues, or can populate it in their cloud and then get recurring revenue from that as well. These companies will be able to take advantage of this. So an iPhone will look more and more like a collection of specific chips for doing the things that an iPhone does. Or maybe the Apple Watch is even a better example. It will look like a bunch of stuff for doing, like, you know, watch and health tracking and motion sensing and location, all that kind of stuff, with a little rump of a CPU that's just there to, like, marshal it all together. But watch apps will become less and less valuable over time, because they can only really do the marshalling stuff, and they start to drain the battery whenever you do it. It will be taking advantage of the custom hardware that really makes the thing sing, and that will be harder for a programmer like me, who's stuck in the sort of C mindset or the Swift mindset or the Java mindset, to do. It'll be harder for us to work out how to solve the problem in a way that's really good for a computer. Our heyday has really gone since the demise of the Pentium 4. So a happy note to finish on. I hope that this has been an interesting and enjoyable episode. I always welcome feedback. You can find me on Twitter, iwasleeg, I-W-A-S-L-E-E-G. You can send me an email, grahamlee@acm.org, or you can comment on the post on the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers blog. Thanks very much for listening. I will talk to you again soon.